Good evening and welcome to Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic and my name is Debbie. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God.
God, grant me the serenity
to accept
the things I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing Step 10, and I'd like to introduce our panel. We have Connie and Jim coming to speak with us on Step 10. And it's a short one. We only have three paragraphs tonight, and I'll first read the step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. We're going to start on page 84. Okay. This thought brings us to Step 10. We've just done 8 and 9, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And Connie, I'll let you introduce yourself and you'll be first to share.
Okay, I'm Connie, an alcoholic.
Connie.
And very grateful to be here this evening and to be a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. This format is a little bit different than where I got sober up in Marblehead, Massachusetts, a little tiny community up there. If you're familiar with Salem, the witch city, then it's right near that. I was born and raised and lived in Lynn, Massachusetts, which was maybe 10 miles away, a city of about 80,000, and of course, God forbid I should go to any meetings there because I'm going to see somebody I know. So I got sober and grew up really in Marblehead till I moved down here. David sent the three paragraphs to me, and I knew what it would be with Step 10. I looked at each of them, and I came into the halls in June of 1987, and I didn't walk in here and know immediately that I was, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing about alcoholism. And I'm just giving you just a little bit of a brief so that I can get to the step 10, that when I came in, it took me 7 months before I could surrender. I came in here and I raised my hand and I said, I'm a newcomer. I couldn't say that word, alcoholic. I'd rather choke to death. And but I had wonderful women surround me with that unconditional love that said, Connie, just keep coming no matter what. And then I finally hit that terrible bottom on January 12th of 1988. And so my first sobriety date is January 13th, 1988. And what I did for the next 2 years and 9 months, I did not drink. I went to a lot of meetings. I did have a sponsor. And I basically was two-stepping in here, which probably most of you know what that is. And if you're a newcomer, you don't. That's step one I was adhering to. And step 12, welcoming newcomers and coming in. I was going through the steps, and step 10 was talking with my sponsor was important to be able to do that on a daily basis. Step 10 was, I was always able to say I'm sorry. In my married life and with my husband, if something was wrong, we'd always have these arguments, and I always say, I'm sorry. And then I was looking for some feedback, and we didn't because it just created more of an argument. And so for me, with this step 10, even though I was able to say I'm sorry, and oftentimes I had to write it because I knew I was going to there's going to be a confrontation, and I just wanted to clean my side of the street. In order to do it, oftentimes I had to write. For me, this step was about restraint of tongue and pen. Very much so for me. And in the process, because my husband was an adult child and an only child, and his mom was one of us, but she died from lung cancer. She would have died from this disease had she kept drinking. But he never was able to say I'm sorry. But I always did. I always apologized if I said something wrong. But I always wanted to have the last word and be right. You know, it's progress, not perfection. But one of the things that I came in here was with a huge ego, and my pride and perfection were the only character defects that I thought I had. But for me, it went along, and what was read in this paragraph, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I had a tremendous amount of fear, but I wouldn't be able to admit to that when I came in here. I thought, I'm just one of these people that can just do whatever I have to do. And I had a lot of control issues. But as I say, with step 10 for me, I fell into a lot of emotional booby traps that they talk about in the step book in step 10. Because what would happen is when I would try to make that amends and make that apology and we got into something and he'd come back at me and I just get so much anger that I would do what it talks about not doing, and that was that I would sulk. Or I wouldn't talk to him probably for maybe 2 days, maybe even a week. The silent treatment. It was horrible. I was not really doing what was the right thing to do as far as I was trying to say I'm sorry, but I wasn't really adhering here. And I know that's that for me, and as I share in the next paragraph, you'll see why this part of step 10, I was always saying I'm sorry, but I wasn't really grasping the totality. I didn't have the totality of this disease, nor did I, feel like I was, I didn't feel like I was doing the best I could do. But at that time, that's all I could do. I think that's all I really want to share on this particular paragraph. I'd like to turn it to Jim.
Perfect. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jim Willis, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
Sobriety date, August 23rd, 1982. I'm a member of the principals group. We meet on Tuesday night in Chesapeake, closed meeting. I sponsor folks, and I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, and I'm one of the members that tries to stay pretty active in there. Sometimes it's because of the group conscience, They say you need to be active. So leave it at that. Step 10. I was telling folks tonight, I come down, I says, you know, I says, always pray before I do any of these kind of things. And the prayer is, I said, okay, God, let me get out of the way. I said, just let me get out of the way, and you do whatever you need to do to me. So right now, you know as much about what I'm going to say as I do. But the main thing is that when I say getting out of the way, it sort of leads me into step 10. I tell guys I sponsor a lot that defects of character, step 6 and 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. For me, those seem to be the things that lead me right into step 10. The God of my understanding has a sense of humor, and the way that usually works is like this. I go in, the defects of character start leaping in there. Everything from fear to pride to you name it, resentments, all of it starts kicking at one time. And the next step it says, and humbly ask him to remove them. Sometimes I don't want to remove. I just want to be there. Now, it takes a little while with 6 and 7 before sometime I can ever move up to step 10, which suggests we take personal inventory and continue to set right in mistakes. You know, sometimes we say sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And sometimes the only reason I do it quickly is if something happens where I'm feeling some kind of emotional pain or something. And I know that I've just harmed another human being, and not physically, but emotionally, which I don't have a right to do. And because I'm not the quickest study in the group, there's sometimes these defects of character, it's sort of like putting a dog on a short leash. And just about every time I see that gate start to open up a bit, I take a mad dash to that gate and get almost there, think I've got it this time, and all of a sudden that leash just jerks me back. And one more time, the character defects. Now, I'd like to say that when it jerks me back, I just don't run for the gate again, but that's not true. Many times I keep running for that gate until I'm just exasperated. I'm wore out, I'm laid off over to the side, and just, I'm in an agony. And I know that the God of my understanding must be laughing about that and says, look at you, Joker. You still don't have a good clue. But it takes that sometime, and I'm only talking about my own personal experience here. But it seems like when those defects of character, especially fear and pride, those, and it talks about those being opposite sides of the same coin. And I know in my case it has been. When pride gets in the way, or I think somebody has harmed me in some way emotionally, my pride gets in there, and the next thing you know, I'm fearful about what are they going to find out about me. Maybe I still don't quite measure up. And it really doesn't make any difference if anybody else is even around me or not. This can all just be going on in my head. But what I love about step 10 is it forces me, when nobody's watching, to do the right thing. Doesn't mean it's always easy. I remember many years ago, I was still active duty military, and it was I got a set of orders to go out to the West Coast. And I'd been sober a period of time by then. And I come in, and I was going to get paid and get my money and everything before I headed out to California. And they had a policy back then that if you were a chief or above, you could go right to the head of the line and get paid. You didn't have to wait in the line. You go right to the front. So I was chief, and I come in there, and there's a long line. Well, I just go on up with my pay record all the way to the front. And on my way up, there's a second-class petty officer in the line waiting to be paid. And as I walk by, he says, hey, chief, he says, there's no head of the line privileges here. I began to let him know exactly who did he think he was talking to. I didn't need his authorization, and it was not pretty, I'll just say that. And so I went on up to the front of the pay line, and the senior chief was up there. He says, hey, chief, come on in the office. And I just sort of smirked a little bit to this second class, yeah. So I go on in there. He says, man, he says, I hate to tell you this. He says, a week ago, the captain changed the policy. There's no more head of the line up here for 7 and above. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, Jesus, now what? So here I got to come out of there, and I said, well, man, how about let me have a smoke in those days? Can I have a cigarette? She said, yeah, sit down and have a cigarette, chief. And I was sitting there smoking. It was a long, I was hoping that second class would be paid by the time I rolled out of there, because everybody in there had seen me, you know, all the other men in that line. So he, sure enough, I come out, and he was still in that line. So I'm walking down there with my pay record in my hand, and he's got a smirk on his face this time. And but I knew one thing. Whether anybody was walking and watching or not, you folks had taught me by then that if I wanted to stay sober, I needed to do the right thing when nobody was watching. And when I got to that guy, I looked at him and I said, you were right and I was wrong. And that's all I could get out without getting hot again. But I went to the back of that line. I had no more got to the back of the line. The senior chief comes back out of his office. He's, chief, go ahead, come on up. I'm going to go ahead and pay you now. And I'm thinking to myself, well, sucker, why didn't you do that before I took this long walk back in here where I had to make amends to some joker? But the matter was is that it taught me a lesson. Sometimes I haven't always been real tolerant and patient with other individuals, particularly when it comes to my pride getting in the way. And so, you know, and it says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. That's what this step allows me. It allows me to finally get right with who I am. Not with who you think I am, but to use these steps. We always talk about these steps being spiritual principles, a way to live our lives. And if I truly believe that, today I believe that. I believe it to the very parts of my being because I've got faith in those things today because I've watched them turn out in my life when I least expected it. All of a sudden things turned exactly, and not because I was forced in to do the right thing. It was because I genuinely wanted to do the right thing. I remember my mom and my wife had a conversation years ago, and I heard my wife tell my mom, she says, you know, Mom, she says, Jim's a good man. She says, he's a good husband. He's a good father. He's a good grandfather. She says, he's a very different man than the man I married, and she says, that's a good thing. My mom turned around and says, the boy finally learned. He said, when he put that bottle down, I always knew he could be a better man. Well, the matter of it, if all I would have done is put the bottle down, I'd still be a very miserable man. But you all taught me something in here, how valuable it is to continue looking at selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And those things can crop up real quick. And those are my defects of character. And when they're flaring, I don't care if anybody's in my way. I can't see it. And my sponsor often says, he says, 6 and 7, we got to ratchet those things down. We go back to step two and say, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Because in those moments when I'm really crazy like that in my own head, there is no sanity in the house. And until I can calm that thing down enough to acknowledge who I am, and in that moment it's not pretty, I need to clean it up. And it says, and then down at the bottom, it says, we resolutely turn to our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. This whole fellowship is based on helping someone else. And the byproduct of that is we're helped in the making. And in those times when I can turn and try to be of service to another human being, and I don't mean just members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Service can come from many different positions, many different people we can be of service to. My sponsor often says he does some volunteer stuff in an elderly home. And I told him, I said, well, man, be careful. One of us will be in there before long. You know, I says, maybe I'll come visit you. He said, you're going to be there before I will. But the point is, he says, you know, he says, it's amazing what we can do. A lot of those folks that are sitting there in those elderly homes never get a visitor. Their families have finally walked away. There's no one ever comes to see them. He said, it's amazing how you can, for a moment, by talking to one of these folks and just chit-chatting with them, you can break up their loneliness just in that moment. You may be the only individual that spoke to them in days and genuinely just sat there. And I've never forgotten that. It's about just reaching out our hand sometimes and not expecting something in return other than doing the right thing. And that's, for drunks, that's a foreign concept. I mean, it was for this drunk. Unless there was a payoff in it and I was going to get something out of it, you wouldn't get nothing out of me. I mean, I would flower it up and try to cover my wrong motives, but that was the bottom line. That's the way it worked. So I have to still constantly do this, and sometimes I have to be reminded, hey, Jim, how about taking a look at the 10th step on this one? Because I think if we do that, we'll stay here. And it talks in one of these paragraphs going forward about what are the kind of things, why do we do this? There's a payoff in it for us. But it's good to be here tonight, and it's good to be with other folks of like mind and being with others who are in the fellowship. And it's a pleasure being here tonight with the folks up here on the other end of the thing. And so I'm going to shut up now and let them talk.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
We're going to continue on page 84. Here's my big lesson. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Connie.
On this particular paragraph, what she just read, that position of neutrality, when I first came in, and for those 2 years and 9 months that I was talking about really being a dry drunk, I would always say, I'm not neutral. I'm not neutral at this point to alcohol. And I know that, I know now that I had a reservation deep down. I hadn't accepted. I talk a lot when I go to the first step meetings. We didn't have this particular, as I said, this format up in Massachusetts, but I went to a lot of step meetings. And I also went to, we had up there, I went to retreats. I went to the state meetings with my sponsor and my sponsees. But we had what we called AWOL meetings, a way of life. And it was closed. It was maybe, sometimes it would be 20 women. There was mixed groups, but I preferred to do it with just women. And there'd be maybe 20 of us in that room that would do it for 32 weeks, and we would go through an intense study, something like you like this is, you know, big step book study. Well, that's what we did for almost, 32 weeks, I guess it was, zeroing in on each of the steps and talking, and a lot that hadn't done a fourth and fifth were able to do it in those AWOLs. In any event, I know for me, after that 2 years and 9 months, and that reservation was there, that I did pick up. And I know today that it was about not having accepted the totality of this disease. And so I went from that September, and my son was over in the Persian Gulf War. He had graduated from the Naval Academy, had gone on, that war was going on, and in the middle of all of that, I was surrounded by these people that had been put in my life, that God put wonderful people in my life. And I remember standing outside of my the big book meeting and saying, "Connie, you're going to be okay." And I said, "I don't know." And I struggled. And I remember being at the gym. I'll tell this one particular story. I remember being at the gym, and I didn't know what had happened. It had come over the news, but I just got to my meeting, and the chairperson was chairing the meeting. And I walked up the steps, and it was just silent. And he said, "Connie, we're with you." And I didn't know that the bombs had just gone off. And my son was sitting in the middle of the Persian Gulf in his ship. And I didn't know. That fear came over me. And the women then said, you know, one of them spoke right up and said, "I'll go home and stay with you tonight, Connie." The meeting proceeded and continued. But I just want to tell you that that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you're there for each other. We're there for each other. That's why the we, it's a we program. It's not a me, I program. And so after I was able to get, you know, finally surrender, and put the drink down and accept the totality of this disease, that's when I started working with my sponsor, did those AWOLs, those three different AWOLs. And for me, that's when it began a lot with my marriage then, because that was most of the time for me. I seemed to be, in my workplace, I was okay. And in my church, I was very involved in my church. But I actually had to back off from that because I just couldn't do it. At the end of my drinking, I had so much fear and so much that I had to. I had a dear woman, Kitty, I remember her saying, I said, Kitty, I can't do it. And she said, you can say, I couldn't say no. And she said, just tell them that you're unable to do it at this time. And that was a big monkey that I got off my back because I never wanted to say no. And so she helped me with that. But when it came to step 10, this particular paragraph means so much to me because I no longer had to be fighting my husband. I no longer had to have the last word. I didn't have to have everything perfect. That was my problem when I came in. I told you pride and perfection, everything, my ducks had to be in the row, and if everything is okay, then I'm okay, right? I'm just fine, and you know what fine stands for. And it was just, I just struggled so much those 2 years and 9 months. But a day at a time, working with my sponsor, working with sponsees that then God put into my life, I was able to really work this program. And the steps are in order for a reason. And the reason that I hadn't been able to go through the steps is because I couldn't get to the third step. I was not willing. I was holding on for dear life. I was not willing to turn my life over to the care of a higher power. I always had a loving God in my life. The problem for me was that I wasn't spiritually connected. I did not have that. I was known as the church lady. I was known as, in my home group, I was the church lady and the cookie lady because I made cookies every Wednesday night for my home group on Thursday nights. That was my home group was Thursday nights in Marblehead. And it was very difficult for me until I really, you know, as I said, was the acceptance. And in here, you'll have a new attitude towards liquor. And I was. I mean, I could then be around it. I was told, and of course, in the beginning, in those 2 years and 9 months, my in-laws would come. My drink. I was a real drunk. I mean, wine was like water to me, and beer never got past these lips. I won't tell you what I thought it tasted like. I was just a boozer. I just, you know, it was straight Manhattans. It was straight booze out of the bottle. That's the end before I got here. That's what I was doing. Just, you know, they always said the drunk, which I couldn't relate to it. I mean, you know, that's the drunk and the rubber boots and the raincoat and in the gutter. Well, I was all three, except I wasn't in the gutter, but I was close to it. But I, you know, I would drive the car and have that brown paper bag and had to swig it before I could even turn the engine on. It was a horrible, horrible way to live. But as I, started going through the steps then and the AWOLs that I took, this beautiful, beautiful program really started happening for me. And all the, what we talk about, the gifts that come and the promises, you know, they begin to happen for me. And I was able to, when I was making those amends, whether it was my sons or my, you know, I have two sons. And now they're married, of course, and have children. I have wonderful grandchildren. But and with my parents, it was really within the confines of my immediate family where I did the most damage. Not to say that I didn't affect my sister. I have one sibling, and it's a sister. We worked together for 10 years in the middle of my 40-year insurance career. I had 20 years, and then the middle 10, I was working with her. And she was affected by that because our dad was one of us. He never got the program, but he was one of us. And so I know for me that I'm able to make those amends. It says here, we have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. And that's what it was. And we're neither cocky nor are we afraid. And that's all of that came to be for me for the next 19 years. And I moved here in 2004. Our oldest son was stationed here in Norfolk. He had moved here in 2002. And our other son was still back in Massachusetts with our only two other grandchildren. The commander had two sons, and my other son had two children, but she, my only granddaughter. And he moved here to Virginia Beach. And so at that point, and my grandkids never saw me drink. And with that step 10 and those years that I was, you know, working the steps, in my third year, both my parents died within 12 weeks of each other, and a thought of a drink never occurred to me. And then we had a beautiful, in 1994, we had a beautiful Naval Academy wedding, and there was an open bar because the mother and father of the groom usually do that night before reception. And Sean wanted to have the open bar, and I was okay with that. It was, you know, it was flowing and so forth. And I was okay with that because I know deep down that, you know, a drink wasn't an option for me, and I could be around it now. Whereas in those first 2 years, you know, my in-laws came over, and they drank what I drank, those Manhattans. So I had to serve them. You know, I had to serve them. And Daddy had to have his beer. My dad was, as I said, was one of us, but he didn't get the program. But I was always able to then, with my husband particularly, able to make that amends, and I didn't have to go in for the fight. You know, it was like I cleaned my side of the street, and if he accepted it, fine. And we had a lot of stuff that went on in that marriage before I even got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful that I'll share that in the next when we read the next paragraph, because that's what it was. But when I moved down here in 2004, of course I left my sponsor. There was no family left. His dad had died in 01. My parents had already died, as I said, in 94, but I had left a wonderful, wonderful home group and those that were real close to me, three sponsees, my sponsor, a mentor, and a spiritual advisor. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easy. You know, change is not easy for a drunk, and it wasn't for me. But it took me a little while to get my home group was the Prince of Peace in Chesapeake. That's where we landed because our oldest son was in the Hickory area, and the son with the granddaughter was in Great Bridge, and my sister followed me 1 week later because she was the one that said, you need to go. You need to be with your two sons and four grandkids. And so she followed me, and I started going to the meetings. But the dynamics were going on with the two daughter-in-laws. But I continued to go to meetings, and I can say that for me, I know that you have to continue to work this program and come to a lot of meetings. And I was doing that. But I'm going to stop there because I really want to continue when this last paragraph is read. It's what happened.
Thank you.
For me.
Thanks, Connie. Yeah, it's you know, it's always interesting when, not just sitting up here, I'd much rather be sitting back there in the audience and listen to somebody else up here, because it's what I found too over the years is when I listen to someone and I really listen closely, for me it's almost like this spiritual connection. They may have a very different, you know, outcome or different story than what I've got, but the spiritual thing you can't argue about. Spiritual principles are just spiritual principles. So it doesn't make any difference how we're dressed up on the outside or what we've done with our lives. It's about, has alcoholism taken us to our knees? And if it has, have we fought our way back? And when it says we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time, Sandy will have returned. We'll be seldom interested in liquor. I do some work now where I do some traveling around. I'm with a group of professional people, and invariably we have dinner at night, almost for men and women alike, almost invariably always drink. I mean, it's just a way of life, and it's rare that one of them ever get intoxicated. I never understood it, and I still don't to this day. I think, you know, why did, and that stuff, you know, where they start swirling it around and sniffing it, it just irritates me to this day. It's like, throw it down if you're going to drink the thing. What are you whipping it around? You're going to spill it on somebody, you know? And it's just, but there are folks that can do that, you know, and I don't even know sometimes they even get a sip out of it. You know, they're using it for the swirling effect or something. But my sanity still hasn't fully, you know, returned. My bride of 46 years would tell you that too. But what I'm getting at here is that it says we got a new attitude about liquor. It doesn't make any difference to me today if they're drinking. It has no no thought in mind at all, even if it's been a rough day or whatever. That's not in the thing. I remember many, many years ago, my home group was the Roosevelt Gardens group, and this was back in the mid-80s. And everyone in there, men and women alike, had 25-plus years of sobriety. They used to have this standing joke, you know. We all smoked in those days. They said, don't get a cigarette too close to them. They've been dry so long, they'll go up and smoke. You know, just stay away from those folks. But I remember an old timer there one time, he says, one of the greatest gifts he ever got was when he could plan something for a Friday night other than drinking. He said he doesn't know exactly when that date occurred, but when that craving to get a drink of liquor on Friday and Saturday and Sunday, and that think about, do I have enough money? Who am I going to go? Am I going to get in any trouble? How do I need to cover my hind end if I'm... I don't know, and I don't know how many people in this room that have been sober for a number of years know the exact time and date that was lifted. I don't. I've had different awakenings and awarenesses have happened over the years. I don't know the exact time, but I do know when it happened, this happened. That insanity to be around or to have a drink, that always plotting, always figuring out how I was going to get it. Even if I didn't have any money, who could I borrow from, you know, or where could I? It was that constant, incessant. And even when I wasn't drinking, I knew I would drink. And so the obsession was always there. And so that when that obsession was lifted, it was amazing. I mean, it was beyond amazing. It was another one of those spiritual experiences I had that, because up until then, I was holding on. I was simply holding on not to pick up that first drink. And if anyone's ever been in that room, in that space, or you're sitting there tonight, believe this. If you stay here and you begin to try to walk through these steps and gain from these spiritual principles, it'll be lifted. You may not know the date and the time, but it will be lifted. That's a guarantee of Alcoholics Anonymous and these spiritual principles. Because I haven't seen anyone who's been able to stay sober for any period of time where that wasn't lifted. And I, you know, and we don't, sometime after we've been here a while, we have a tendency to sort of forget that. But think back on those days when you first come in here, when the craving was still so strong, you didn't know if you'd make it or not. And you didn't know if all these folks here would, you know, you heard what they were saying. But it's like here just a moment ago when Connie said, you know, like being a church lady. Now, I could see the church lady going down with a brown paper bag swigging, drunk as a skunk as she's heading down the highway. Now, who would have thought a woman like this sitting up here tonight, all sophisticated looking, would be swigging out of a bottle and slugging that wine down? See, it doesn't make any difference what the external package is. Alcoholism is a nasty illness for all of us that have been affected. And this is the only way I've ever found a way out. And it says, we will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. You know, it's amazing how this happens, and you hear people, and it isn't always about the age of the person. I've watched young folks come in here and latch on this thing, and I mean, just amazing what happens in their lives. I mean, just remarkable. And I've seen folks come in here in their mid-70s and get sober and take it to the end. Maybe only live for another 4 or 5 years, but 4 or 5 of the happiest years they ever had in their life. How does that happen? You know, I have to just... I don't know all this stuff, you know, how it happens. I just know that it happens. And I've got a lot of friends in this fellowship today around this country and outside this country that are spiritual men and women as a result of doing this stuff. And at one time were bad drunks. And I hate to tell you, ladies, but men didn't have a market on the bad drunk department. I see a couple out there now that I've heard their stories. I mean, they were bad drunks. I mean, they'd rival any of us. Some of us men thought we was all toughed up and everything. Some of these women, I'd hate to run across them in a dark alley. So, I mean, the truth of the matter is that spiritual principles didn't work. If they absolutely didn't work, I don't think a single one of us would be sitting here tonight to have any period of sobriety. Because our lives have changed dramatically. But it also says down in here, it says, we feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I feel that way. Even whenever I'm acting crazy as a loon, the thought of not of having a drink is not in the mix. I'm just crazy as a loon, so I can't blame it on the booze. I'm just nuts. You know, and there's my bride often says, she says, you don't think right. She says, there's never telling what's going to come out of that mouth. She says, what is the matter with you? I said, well, let me ask you this. What's the matter with you if you're still here after 46 years? I said, evidently, you're not working with a full brick either. She said, that's exactly what I'm talking, that old crazy nonsense. But the truth is, it says we have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. How many of us in this room tonight have ever, back when we were drinking, said, that's it. I'll never do it again. I mean, I could pull that old beat-up CD or out in a minute. Oh, honey, I'll never, let me back in the big bed. I promise I've never have another taste of liquor. The heat would go down. Well, maybe I made too much of this thing. You know how we get. You know, I mean, I overplayed my hand here, and I need to rein this thing back in. But the truth was, instead, the problem had been removed. It does not exist for us. We were neither cocky nor are we afraid. And that's the way it is. I can speak only from my experience. I'm not cocky about the idea of being sober, but I am certainly not afraid that I'll have to pick up that first drink. I have other solutions, and it's based on a spiritual way of life. Does that mean I can't have fun? No, I have a lot of fun. Have a lot of good time. Got a lot of friends both in and out of the fellowship. And at the end of my drinking, you could have counted any people I had around me down to about two or three. You didn't have to fill up a whole hand. That's the difference. People say, well, you've always been pretty outgoing. That's not how I was when I drank. I stayed very much to myself. I didn't want people around. You sitting in this room and these spiritual principles has put this old boy back on a track that he never expected. I mean, I'd run totally off all the tracks. But then it says, that is the experience, but here's the keeper. It says, that is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Now, I'm pretty old. I'm probably one of the oldest one, if not the oldest in this room. But I go to the Y about three, four times a week. Now, I don't do anything hard now, I'm going to tell you. But I keep active. My son asked me once, he says, Daddy, he says, what are you getting all buffed up in your old age? I says, it's got nothing to do with buffing up. It's the other B word. He says, what's that? I said, it's called breathing. I said, I just like to stand upright, you know? But it says in fit spiritual condition. Think about if you do any kind of physical activity at all, even if you walk, whatever it is. We seem to feel better. This tells me if I want to stay fit spiritually, there are certain exercises I need to do. I need to be able to talk with the God of my understanding and on occasion listen. I seem to do more of the talking than listening. And the other piece to that is try some of those things when all of a sudden someone crosses my path and they said, Jim, you ever thought about doing something like this? Or I'll hear one of you say something. And it's, again, it's not about the period of sobriety. It's about where you stand in that moment spiritually that I'm able to connect. I'm able to hear something. I said, I'm going to try that. I think maybe I can do that. Maybe I don't do it as well as you. Maybe I do it better. It's not about that. It's about doing it, showing up and suiting up because I want to stay here. That's the practice of step 10. That's what it does for us. I can't do that if I'm constantly covering my tracks because I'm afraid someone I hear is going to see me when I'm not expecting anyone to see me and they see the real deal. My hope is they see the same real deal if I'm sitting in a food line or I'm sitting at a red light. Or whatever the situation is, not just when we show up in these rooms. And you're going to have to beat me to get me up out of here. I'm going to tell you what. Because I'm not going anywhere easy. I plan on doing whatever it means to do what I got to do to stay here. Because I've seen the power in my life and other people's lives in this room tonight. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. We're going to read on page 85. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is a proper use of the will.
This, to me, is one of the most important paragraphs, at least in my journey, for me, that's just been read. As I said to you, the second time that I surrendered was May 6th of 1991. And I was on that journey for 19 years and moving here in 2004. And when I stopped early, it was because when I did move down here, there were things that were going on family-wide. The family dynamics had changed. And I was taking it all on. I wanted to control. I was taking back control again. I was trying to make everything perfect. And I was working with my sponsor. I have a wonderful sponsor down here. Actually, I'll ask you to say prayers for Millie S. But in any event, I didn't realize I was struggling, but I was trying. I was, how can I say what I did before, was I stuffed everything with alcohol. I washed everything down with alcohol. I was stuffing it. And that's what I was doing with these situations that were going on between my daughter-in-laws. But my sons were okay with it, but they were trying to each be compliant or being with their wives. And I was trying to, you know, just make a mess out of things is what I was doing. And so when she read this here, we are not cured of alcoholism. I mean, when I came in here, one of the things that I did say, and I would say it very often, I knew that there was another drink in me. But I don't know if there's another recovery. I don't know if there's another recovery in for me. And I would share that a lot at my home groups and all my groups in Marblehead. And when I came down here, and my sponsor said, continue to carry that message, Connie, when you come down here. It was a little getting different to different types of meetings and so forth. And so I think it was 2010. And one of the things I know, too, is that you can be on a dry bender. You can have that emotional hangover. And it's clearly says here, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And for me, it's a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us. And so I received my 19-year chip down here, and that was in May of 2010. And that September, I went back up. Every year since I moved down here, I went back up to be with my girlfriends. I have two college friends and one girlfriend from the first grade, and we've always been close. They're not drinkers. You know, like what he was talking about, the glass of wine and swirling it around and, you know, maybe taking a sip and putting it down on the table. And my other girlfriend that I've known since the first grade doesn't even drink. And we were up at a restaurant up there and having a great time and sitting at the table in this restaurant. And one of the college friends said, Connie, and they knew that I didn't drink. I had never told them where I was coming from, but they knew I didn't drink. And most of the time I was I would drive, but I mean, they could have driven with their one glass of wine. I don't know how many DUIs, I never had one, but I could have easily. And as I said, I fell in love with booze, whiskey for sure, at the age of 12. And it was the taste for me. I absolutely loved the taste. Anybody, I would hear some of the people in my home group and back up, and you know, I never liked the taste of booze, but boy, I like that effect. Oh, I said, boy, you missing something. But that was just for me, because I absolutely loved the taste of whiskey. Manhattans and Black Russians. But you can have them, thank you very much, not me. And so what happened was, I'm up there, and she said, she was looking at the menu, and she said, I never liked dry martinis. I didn't like martinis, period. And she said, look, there's a rum martini, and it's got blackberry in it, liqueur. And she's naming the different things. She's looking at the menu, at the liquor menu, and I'm reading, you know, what I'm going to eat here. And she's, come on, Jai, just try it. And I said, no. I said twice no. And the third time the waitress came, and I said, okay. And that drink was in front of me. And I drank the drink. That was all I had, that one drink. And I was staying with somebody else, not either of these three girls. I was staying with somebody else. And on the way back to her home, I was at the liquor store just to pick up two nips. I'm going to have those two nips. And then I was with the girls. And I always believed, you know, they said it was the first drink. I don't know if there's any newcomers in here, but I always share that, you know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I said, no, my God, I buy a half gallon every night, and I get to that halfway mark, and I eat something that I wouldn't have eaten, and that's why I threw up and I was sick, because I drank and I ate something that I shouldn't have. I didn't get that concept, you know. And but right back, and Doc in our home group would always share, you know, it's like... It's like the engine. It's all greased in oil, just waiting. And that's what happened. As soon as I put that drink in and it went down, I set off that horrible, horrible compulsion and the obsession. And I can tell you, for me, and I share this because it's... And I had a hard time with it in the beginning. I'm talking with my sponsor, Millie, and so forth. I knew that... that I had to do some work, some serious work with her, and that's what I started going. I can tell you honestly that had a hold of me for 3 years, and it was tough. I was coming to meetings. I'd maybe get a couple of days, and then I'd be right there to the liquor store, and I thought, dear God, I remember that. I remember Rocco reading in my home group at our speaker meeting when I was first trying to get sober. And it's in how it works. There are some people who are constitutionally incapable of getting honest. And when I first was getting sober, I said, dear God, that's me. I can't get this. That was in that seven-month period. This time, I knew that this was a gift. And I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. But it had me. It had me again. And I was coming to meetings because I knew. I always felt safe, and I knew this is where the answers were and whatever. And I kept coming, and I was working with Millie, my sponsor, and I was trying to, and I had to do that. I had to do another fourth and a fifth step. I don't believe that, for me, there's cycles in our sobriety. At least there was for me. There's different areas, and as we grow, sometimes it doesn't mean just because I did that fourth and fifth step, whatever's happening in your life at that time, you have to look at that and know that you need to address that, and that's what I had to do. And I was doing that, and I was coming to the meetings, and we have a timeshare in Aruba, and I still was, you know, and my husband hadn't really caught. We had gone on a cruise in the middle of that. I think it was that... I had picked up in that September, I think on November, we had gone on a cruise, and I remember going into Cozumel, or wherever it is that they were having all the rum cakes and the rum and so forth, and he wasn't aware of what was going on, and so I picked up the rum cake, of course, and then I picked up the five bottles that were in a row, and he says, well, what are you getting that for? And I said, well, you know Scott and Sean, they love that rum and rum and the Coke and so forth, and wasn't saying anything to him because I hid it very well. And I had that, and that went home. And then another time we were on a ship, and I mean, it's all that stuff that comes back that we do when we're drunks and trying to hide it and and it had a hold of me. It really did. And but I wanted to get to that last night in Aruba, and it was and I'd been asking for help. I'd been on my knees. I was taught that in the very beginning, you know, to get on my knees and ask that higher power. For me, it was always God. To remove this horrible, horrible obsession, and I was doing that for 3 years, and it was April, whatever it was, April. I'm not sure now. It was April 6th. Yes, it was April 6th. We were due to come home that night, and they had the bell goes off at 4 o'clock, and I had one drink, and then we went up to our rooms, and we're getting packed and ready to, you know, head to the airport, and got home. And I don't know what it was, but God lifted that obsession. And I haven't had to pick up a drink since that day. I'm eternally grateful that I'm one of the ones that was able to get back here, because I stood beside people in my home group at Little Hall. We actually had a Little Hall, Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew where I was every night. On the back of the chairs, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps were engraved in wood on the wall, the first step being at the bottom, because that's where we come in, at the bottom, up the set, and all the slogans were in that little hall. And for me, it was incredible. And I stood beside people outside that little hall that would pick up that drink. And the door doesn't always swing both ways. They say keep coming no matter what. And it works, but you have to work it. But I honestly know that there's people, and I won't tell some of the horror stories that I saw that picked up those, and I thought, it kept going through my mind, you know, am I ever going to be able to draw that sober breath? And I have a real respect for alcohol. I know this program works. It's a gift. I know you have to work with your sponsor. You have to stay close. And I know right here what it says. What happened for me is what it says here, that we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And my spiritual condition was not where it should have been when I went up there in 2010 to Massachusetts. There was a chink in that 19 years, that beautiful foundation that I had built. There was a chink in it. I slipped through that crack. I have to share, it was very difficult for me at first, but with the help of my sponsor, I was able to share that. You know, I always wanted to receive that 25-year chip, and I always wanted to just say, but you know what? Today's the day I don't drink. Today's the day I asked for help. This is the drill that I was taught. Get up in the morning and ask for help. Center my day around a meeting. Don't drink. And when I put my head on the pillow tonight and I ask God and I thank God for a day of sobriety, then I'm a howling success at what Alcoholics Anonymous asks of this drunk, to not pick up that first drink. Thank you, God. Thank you, AA. That's all I have to share. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, you got a 1-minute wrap-up?
Okay. Well, we'll keep this right within it. On that, I'll say this. It says, when we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Some in this room are aware of this, and some may not be. But in approximately 8 years ago, a little over 8 years ago, there was a separation between our family, was just split apart. But we have two children, a daughter and a son. And because of some things that happened between the two of them, it just tore the family up. And for 8 years, we had no communication with our son at all. He refused when he, and his idea was that we had sided with his sister. And looking back, I think he was probably right in that, looking back. But what I'll say is October 28th of 2015, I received a text one morning. It was from the son. He says, Dad, he said, I think it's time I need to reconcile with you and Mom. That's all it said in the text. And he says, can I call you? And I remember that date just as clearly. Now, there have been 8 years that my sponsor and I had talked about a lot of different things regarding that. And my sponsor knew everything about the situation, all of it. But I can't tell you, that day when he called, my wife and I sat there, and we were nervous wreck. We didn't know. It's like 8 years. He'd just been gone. And when he called that day, and we talked at length, he and I and my wife, and he and I have been in contact practically every day since then. Not only face-to-face, when I've made trips there. And I hung on through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and nowhere in that eight-year span did I ever think about picking up a drink. It was never in the equation. Never. And yet here, after all that time, it all turned around. And now we're talking late at night. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I can't say what all this has done. But it has to do, it says, how can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. There were days all I did was the mechanics of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't feel on a high spiritual plane, but I never stopped doing what I was suggested to do from the beginning. Because I believed that if I did that, this stuff would all work out, no matter how it turned out. And it has. And with that, I thank you all for giving me an opportunity to be here tonight and hopefully be of service to everyone and for you to be of service back by just being here. It's real hard to talk if it's just to yourself. I play that pretty well, too. But thanks, folks. Appreciate it.
Thank you both. I think that we heard that this program works when we work it. Oh, let's see. Somebody's got to pass the basket.
Good job, coming.
Oh, thank you. Good job. I'll bring the basket.
You hawking the money again, Jill?
Okay, the seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Announcements. We have the Blue Flyer announcement. Monday, March the 7th, we're having our supper and a speaker, and it's going to be Mark G. from Richmond. 6 o'clock, bring a dish if you want to eat. No, bring a dish if you wish. And 7 o'clock, so he hasn't got to me yet. The speaker will start at 7, and there are flyers on the table. Take some and share them with other groups. It's always a good time. Any other AA announcements? There's the women thing coming up this weekend. The Oceanfront Conference coming up the weekend after that. Lots of AA stuff going on. Okay, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hand. Woohoo! All right. And the important question, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety that would like to introduce themselves, just so we can get to know you?
Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. Welcome. Keep coming.
All right. Very good. Let's see, we've got some literature available. There's paper literature that's for free. The books are for sale. Any one of us can help you with that if you would like to buy a book after the meeting. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. All right. I was going to say, has anyone worked the 12 steps out of the book? Please raise your hand and try and trick y'all to, you know, working with others. But anyway, that's just me. All right. Please feel free to talk to anyone that raised their hand or come up and ask me any questions if you're shy. I'd love to talk to you about sponsorship. Save my life. Smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church because we do share the building with others. We do record our meetings, and upcoming events are posted on the website, and you can find all that at simpleactions.net. And we're going to thank our panel once again. Thank you for coming. And someone's going to read the last two paragraphs on page 164.
My name's Jason. I'm an
alcoholic. Jason.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. Thanks, everybody, right, for being here tonight. And we close with the Lord's Prayer. All right. And while we're rounding up, just in your prayers tonight, we can keep Millie in our thoughts, and also Catherine, who's in this home group, lost a family member. So just kind of keep those people in your prayers. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
All right. Good job, guys. Thank you, buddy.